Welcome to episode 27 of Eye on Horror, or season 2, episode 5, if that's how you're keeping track. I am your host, James J. Edwards, and with me, as always, is Jacob Davidson. How you doing, Jacob?
Doing good and feeling fine.
Feeling fine. And also with us, as always, is John Correa. How you doing, John?
Doing good. You guys aren't going to get rid of me that easily. You know that, right?
Anyway, I'm not done introducing people yet, though, because we have, if you read the episode summary, you already know this, but if you went in blind, you're about to find out that we have, if you've been reading iHorror.com this month at all, you know this guy's name, but we have got Waylon Jordan here. How you doing, Waylon?
I'm great. How are you guys?
Waylon, if you are not familiar with him, he basically becomes the editor of iHorror.com during Pride Month. So if you have been reading the site at all during the month of June, you have read, most likely read stuff he's written, at least read stuff that he has curated. So he kind of takes charge. So we're going to get to that a little bit later on. But for now, there hasn't been a whole lot that has come out since we last talked. I'll go first, though, on what we've seen, because I saw Annabelle Comes Home.
Nice.
And it's by the time this posts, I believe it'll already be, I think it opens this coming week. But it is, I kind of struggle with it because I had a lot of fun with it, but there's nothing in it you have not seen already. It's more of a Conjuring movie than it is an Annabelle movie, because they basically, they go into that basement and all of the objects in the basement, you know, come to life. And Annabelle's behind it, so that's why it's an Annabelle movie. But it takes every trick in the book and every single horror cliche. And the Conjuring universe movies are kind of cliches now anyway. They have that, you know, periods of silence followed by a loud noise that, you know, I mean, but they're so effective. And Annabelle Comes Home is basically more of that. It's, you know, they know it's better than The Nun and Curse of La Llorona, and it's probably on par with Annabelle Creation. So it's a fun little, you know, I mean, if you like those Conjuring movies, you'll be into it, because it's more of the same. Basically, there's nothing too surprising in it. And now I may be the only person who has not seen Child's Play. So you guys talk about Child's Play. Have you seen Child's Play, Waylon?
I have not yet.
Yes,
you
know, I have.
Jacob and Korea have both seen it. What do you guys think of Child's Play, you guys?
Guys,
without spoiling anything, because I need to see it in a couple hours.
Guys, I saw a movie before James.
That's been happening a
do
lot
you know
lately.
How rare this moment is?
Yeah, that's been happening a lot lately.
Oh.
Yeah.
I'm going to spoil everything for you. Okay, so Chucky gets in the spaceship.
then... All right, let's talk Child's Play, though, because, I mean, without spoiling anything, how is it? I've heard nothing but positive about it. People seem to be liking it.
Yeah, I was actually surprised. I really enjoyed it. I mean, it's definitely different from the original, and they updated it for modern times, but I think the best thing about it is that it really recaptured a core theme from the original movie that kind of got lost as things focused more on Chucky, in that, you know, it's really, you know, just how creepy it is that, you know, these big corporations try to market their toys and products as being your kid's best friend, you know, because, like, back then, you know, it was like Cabbage Patch Kids and, you know, those talking dolls, and now we got, like, all
my
the smart,
buddy.
Yeah, smart technology and all that, and yeah, you know, it's, and so it kind of goes further with that, because this is a pure sci-fi horror movie, because this isn't, you know, like a serial killer ghost. It's a artificial intelligence gone awry.
And that's the thing, is that it is an update. Like, they radically changed a lot about the core character of Chucky while making it their own, but still, you know, capturing, like what you said, capturing the original fears with a lot of it. And I liked a lot of what they did with the interconnectivity of devices and technology, like, especially when, you know, the whole thing with cloud and everything's connected through to your buddy. There's a lot of modern fears with technology. I think there's one point where a character goes, this is how every robot apocalypse ever happens.
Yeah,
like, flat out says it, which makes me super pumped for an eventual sequel where Chucky brings about, like, you know, Skynet-esque.
Does it leave itself open to a sequel like that? I mean, are we going to have two different Child's Play universes now?
See, now that's the thing, is my fiance, who's way more into tech than I am, and especially data privacy, I go, oh yeah, no, it makes sense that they would make a sequel. She goes, no, the technology doesn't, like, the technology that they introduce in the movie doesn't make sense for him to come back and all that. And so it's a big debate between the two of us right now.
but when does it really have to make sense for them to bring him back? I mean, they have thought about every single way. I mean, we're not exactly dealing with the most logical thing to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the slasher franchise from the 80s, they came up with some of the most ridiculous reasons to bring back characters. Because, I mean, you know, like, you know, they tried to kill off Jason in part 4, and then they brought him back with a lightning bolt. And then, of course, Freddy famously came back from flaming dog piss. Remember that?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, like, you're dealing with, like, a genre that doesn't really care about the logistics behind things sometimes. But they actually did a decent job of explaining why this particular doll goes the way it does. And it's a surprisingly funny movie. There's a lot of really good humor bits. My only real complaint is... Audrey Plaza's character isn't really given a whole lot of much, you know. There's a little bit of that dynamic from the original where she doesn't believe her kid and she's worried about her kid being crazy and all these things that aren't really there in this new one. Like, there's not a whole lot of focus on her. But everything else I thought was really well, you know, it's a fun movie.
That's kind of a shame because I know you were looking forward to seeing Aubrey Plaza kind of take the reins in a lead role. So it's a little disappointing that they wasted her, apparently. I mean, I haven't seen it, so I don't know.
Well, she has her moments. And also, we got to talk about Mark Hamill because I think he did did a great job as the Robo Chucky.
Listen, I want a copy of that Buddy song on like a 7-inch vinyl. And Bear McCreary's score was awesome. I know they released a behind the scenes video not too long ago where he shows that most if not all the instruments used in the making of the score come from children's toys. So
nice.
There's this really creepy vibe with it just from that little fact that you hear, like the plucking of like a kid's piano throughout and stuff.
As a score junkie, now you've got me really excited to see this because I love it when composers do things like that, especially when it's meaningful like that. You know, so
Bear McCreary's been killing it. I mean,
he did Godzilla.
Yeah. Any other new things that, you know, what else has happened? Jacob?
All right, so I won a Blu-ray copy of The Entity from Dead Right Horror Trivia last week.
I love The Entity, but Scream Factory stuff, I need to wait until it goes on sale because it's a little out of my price point right now. But how is it?
Oh, it's really good. I actually saw it a few years ago at the Arrow Horrorthon. And, you know, it's very, it's we've always talked about this, you know, it's so hard, especially if you're a horror fan, to find something that legitimately scares you and can still stay so scary. But The Entity still holds up. Like, it is, like, terrifying. And for those of you who don't know, listeners, The Entity is supposedly based off a true story, like a haunting of sorts. It's, And it came out from 82, so it was around the time, you know, you had Poltergeist and the Amityville Horror movies. But yeah, so it's basically about this woman that is repeatedly assaulted by, like, a supernatural force. Like, it's very creepy, too, because it's very vague, because this isn't like The Conjuring where it's like, oh, it's a ghost. Like, no, this is like some kind of supernatural thing from beyond that's repeatedly, that's just, like, picked out this one woman, this single mother, and just attacks her over and over. And it's like simultaneously, though, it's like a paranormal investigation type of movie, but also it's very dramatic and very disturbing. So, like, it's still one of those horror movies that holds up. And back on scores, like, it has that amazing theme by Charles Bernstein, you know, the which actually Tarantino borrowed for Inglourious Basterds, like when Hans Landa shows up, it's that exact same theme.
Does he credit the?
Yeah, it's credited.
Charles Bernstein? Okay, because Tarantino does that a lot. He'll borrow, like, I mean, a song from Last House on the Left is in Hateful Eight. Like, literally, he needle drops it. So,
but yeah, no, The Entity still holds up, and it's it's one of those movies that still is legit terrifying to me.
Yeah, you know, some of the some of the special effects in that film just really bother me. Just seeing the impression of the hand on her body.
Yeah.
You can't see the hand, but you're seeing the definite finger impressions on her skin and stuff. That shit scares the hell out of me.
you mean bother you in a good way? Like, not bother you like it takes you out of the movie?
Oh, no. Yeah, it terrified me. I saw that movie when I was about 10, and I really shouldn't have, and... Yeah.
I saw it way too young, too.
Yeah.
Now, I've been watching a lot of Shaft recently because of the new movie. I still haven't seen the new Shaft movie, but that's been my week. But I also did a pretty great double feature. I finally watched my new Blu-ray of Severin's Death Warmed Up.
Yeah.
What a bonkers movie, dude. Yes. Like, I hadn't seen that movie in years, and I completely forgot it. Like, I'm watching it and I didn't remember a thing. I don't know what state of mind or intoxication I was when I first watched it years ago on VHS, but man, that's a crazy movie. I highly recommend that to anybody who just wants to watch some weird Kiwi horror, you know. But another one that really stood out to me was The Car. I finally watched that.
Yes.
Dude. Holy shit.
Jaws.
Why didn't anyone tell me that was the best Jaws ripoff of ever?
Second best, because Grizzly is better.
Because Grizzly's better? I have to add Grizzly to my list.
Wait, you've never seen Grizzly?
No.
Grizzly is literally Jaws with claws. It is, I mean, beat for beat, it is.
But The Car is so good. Like, it was it's so, like, a lot of times, you know, films where it's like, oh, this is where it's trying to be suspenseful. You know, I have that in the back of my head. Not with The Car, man. I was in it. Like, when you see it, when you see, like, a character talking and off in the distance, you just see, like, the sun hit the light of it and you see the reflection of in the background, like miles away, I just start sitting there tensing up. I'm like, oh shit, it's coming. And then it disappears. And then you see it a bit closer. It's like, holy fuck. Like, it did not need a John Williams score in order for you to start going, oh shit, it's coming.
Yeah.
Like,
well, exactly. That's the thing. It's great because it's basically a combination of Spielberg's two earliest greatest movies, Duel and Jaws. It's just, it's just them all mashed up together.
Yeah, The Car is the best example of show 'em the bomb that you're ever going to, because you know this car is there. It's speeding towards these people. They don't know it, but the audience, that's a great one. There's another thing that I've been checking out, and I'm a little ashamed that I've come to this party late because it's an iHorror thing, but have you guys checked out those terror tales on YouTube?
Yeah, I do the write-up on them every week, so...
Oh, okay. So you've seen... I just started diving into those, and they're little, like, you know, 5 minute shorts, so they're, you know, even if you don't like one, the next one will come up pretty quickly. Some of them are really creepy. They're basically akin to well-made student films. You know, they're not, like, you know, super high budget, but they, and apparently they're all true. Is that true?
What they did is they sent out a call and they asked people to, like, send in their stories about creepy shit that happened to them. And then they just did reenactments. And some of them are really intense. There's one called Thud. Can still hear the sound of that.
Oh my God.
That dude hanging from a rope.
Thud. You just spoiled it too, though. Thud is one of the, see, the thing, because they're real, some of them end kind of ambiguously. It kind of reminds me of the shorts in ABCs of Death, because some of them end kind of ambiguously and you're like, oh, did they not write an ending? But it's because they're real, and, you know, they'll say, we never figured out what the deal was with these three clowns in the woods, you know. But Thud is the one that actually does have a payoff, and it's a big one. It's pretty, like, you know, but there's, like, a Ouija board one that, you know, kind of fizzles out as well. But these things are, they're worth checking out. They're pretty fun. I mean, and they're super short. They're little bite-sized snippets.
Yeah, I think you can watch all of them that have been released right now in about 30 minutes. I mean, yes, you could just get through the whole thing. Hunt, one of their more recent ones, was one of my favorites, just from the sound that they used in it and everything. That was a lot of fun.
I started watching it the morning, I think it was actually Friday morning, because by the time I finished, it was like 5 minutes until the new one, which is the social media one. What is it called?
FaceTime.
FaceTime, yes. As soon as I finished, I tried to play that one. It said, this one premieres in 5 minutes, because there was a tag up for it. I'm like, oh, cool. Then I'll come back in 5 minutes. And so I watched the premiere of it. But those are, they're pretty fun. They're cool little, you know, things. If you like Wayland said, if you have a half an hour, just go to YouTube. You know, Terror Tales is what they're called. And I'm a little ashamed that it took me this long to watch them, because it's an iHorror thing, and I should be, you know, I should have been on that from the beginning. But
shame on you, James. Shame on you.
Life gets in the way.
I mean, come on, James. It sounds like you can watch one while you're taking a poo. Like 5 minutes? I mean, if you're like me, you could watch like two or three.
But, yeah. Right, let's move on to our subgenre, which, again, let's do this like we did with Kelly, where everybody just throws one in and then we'll move on.
Yeah.
But what do we got for our subgenre? Jacob, are you going to introduce? We kind of came up with it all together, but
yeah,
let's let Jacob
kind of a group. It was a group effort, so got to credit that. But yeah, we decided to talk about cats of horror, or like horror cats.
Spooky cats. And Let me, I'm going to go first again, because I'm the mic hog, and, you know, and I do the editing anyway. So even if one of you guys starts talking, I'll just snip it and edit myself. My favorite horror cat, spooky cat, is from, and it's a movie. It has a Shout Factory release, but a lot of people haven't seen it. The Legacy.
And yeah,
the cat is actually on the poster. But basically, the Legacy is about a bunch of people who gather in this French mansion, and then they start dying like really weird deaths, like weird supernatural occult deaths. And there's this white long hair cat with one green eye and one blue eye that always seems to be in the room when these people die. And of course, there is a reason for that, which I'm not going to spoil, because you should all go watch The Legacy. But anyway, this little white David Bowie looking cat is my favorite spooky cat.
I call next. So for my choice here, spooky cats, I have to go with Haosu, or House.
Oh, nice.
1960s experimental Japanese haunted house
with a capital E.
Mind fuck. I think the back on the Criterion Blu-ray says it best, that it's like if Dario Argento directed an episode of Scooby-Doo. I always like to add on acid, like if Dario Argento was just tripping on psychedelics and was like, yeah, let's throw everything. They literally throw every in-camera special effect technique in the book at that movie.
Yeah.
And the cat is one of the best things. I mean, even just the poster for it, the black and orange with the cat screaming, is phenomenal. And just like there's all these little weird bits, like there's like a little musical number and the cat's like walking on the piano going back and forth. Man, that I gotta watch that movie again. I watched when we showed it in the theater I managed, we played it 1 week, and I watched it every day that week, because every time I'd walk through the theater I'd go, oh, this is a great part, I'm gonna sit down and watch it, and next thing you know the movie was over. Five times that happened to me.
All right, if I could go next.
Go for it.
All right, well, this is a personal favorite. I'd have to choose Mick Garris's Sleepwalkers. Like, I've been a big fan of that one for a long time, and I feel like it's a pretty unique use of cats, because technically the cats, like the normal cats in the movies, are the good guys, because the bad guys are the sleepwalkers, which are like these kind of anthropomorphic vampire-like cat people who need to suck the souls out of virgins to stay alive. And yeah, I mean, it's definitely kind of campy, but I feel like there's...
Kinda?
Okay, it's really campy. Like, King must have been camping out to make it as campy as it was.
You had posted on your Twitter a picture, a gif from it, of the guy turning into cat to sleepwalker to wear it then back to himself. And I never realized how silly that effect was until you see it looped like that.
Yeah.
it is
a little wacky. I mean, yeah, you know, I'm not really choosing it out of horror, but, you know, it's a fun movie. It's very quirky, and yeah, so, some of the special effects hold up better than others. And I mean, and if there's any cat to choose from, you know, there's Clovis the Attack Cat. Like, I I love that like one of the cats becomes kind of a character, and also it has a revenge subplot because it's kind of like Phenomena, because one of the bad guys kills its master, so Clovis wants revenge. Also, tying things together, like it has a cameo from Mark Hamill too.
How many times is Mark Hamill going to pop up in this episode?
Let's find out.
That's you too. Want to challenge me on that? Because I'm going to go.
All right, what do you got spooky cat-wise, Waylon?
Oh, bring us home. Man. One of my favorites is The Legend of Hell House. Yes. I love that movie, and that cat is everywhere. And it just pops up. I mean, sometimes it's there to scare you. Sometimes it's just watching. And I loved the use of that cat in that movie. That's one of my favorite old haunted house movies. I watch that when I'm up at 2 o'clock in the morning and don't have anything else to do. I'll turn that movie on.
And when that cat attacks her in the movie, it's still brutal. It's still effective. Like most of the time when it's like a small animal attacking someone, you're like, oh, just throw it. But like, man, dude, that cat went to town on her.
Let's do a quick lightning round to bust up any that didn't get mentioned. And speaking of attack cats, the cat from Hell from Tales from the Dark Side of the movie.
Yes.
Going into David Johansen's face. Yes.
And then coming back out again. Holy shit. Yeah.
What other quick mentions we got?
I just saw this recently, The Uncanny. It just came out from Severin. It's like a Amicus anthology with Peter Cushing, who is a writer who believes cats are evil and has three stories to prove it, including one with like a woman getting stuck in a house full of killer cats, and another with like a creepy little girl and her creepy cat, and another where Donald Pleasance is an actor and he's being stalked by a cat. It's pretty cool. It's pretty fun. It has some pretty effective stories. And of course, Peter Cushing ranting about how evil cats are is very amusing.
Well, he's not wrong. Cats are kind of evil. I mean,
true.
Even when they're nice and sweet, there's an evil streak in, I think, all cats.
Oh, definitely.
What about the cat people?
Oh, ooh, yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Let's not forget. Actually, we'll probably discuss the original cat people a little bit more once we get into our main topic. But let's not forget the 80s cat people where Malcolm McDowell's character is trying to fuck his sister. That's a cinematic classic right there.
Yeah, I'm not sure why they added that particular element, but hey, why not? You know, if you got Malcolm McDowell there and you just have him just go for it.
It's so great because the original has like subtle overtones of lesbians.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and lesbianism. And then the 80s one remakes it, and it is not subtle at all about Malcolm McDowell's character and wanting to commit incest. Like,
different taboos for different decades.
All right, well, with that, let's move on to our topic, which our topic this week, because we've got Waylon here and because he basically takes charge of Pride Month, we are going to talk queer horror here. And I know that sounds like low-hanging fruit, kind of like we did Women in Horror with Kelly, but, you know, when you have the authority here, you kind of sometimes you just have to grab the low-hanging fruit. So let's start at the beginning. What do you think... I mean, as far as queer horror movies go, what do you think? Do you think that it starts with like the James Whale, like old Dark House, Frankenstein kind of stuff?
Where
absolutely. Where do you think it goes?
Absolutely. You know, James Whale, who was an openly gay man when it was still illegal to be an openly gay man. He
in Hollywood, no less.
Yeah. And I mean, making movies and just saying, fuck you guys, this is who I am. You know, I mean, he was
making movies that are still remembered today.
Yeah, and he started out with Frankenstein and the Old Dark House. The Old Dark House is still one of my favorite, like, I mean, it set up every haunted house movie that's come after it, and I just love it. And there were a lot of things that he did in that. It was pre-code, so he was breaking gender norms and all of that while he was making the Old Dark House. Then you get to, like, Bride of Frankenstein, and he just had Pretorius go for it. I mean, like, that is the gayest character that hit the screen before probably the lesbian vampires of the 70s. So, you know, I mean, it was camp, and it was all of those things, you know. But yeah, so it started way early, you know. And then the Hays Code came down, and that's when... even though they hadn't really dealt with a lot of openly gay characters before, they started just coding everything, and that's when you started to get the first queer coding going on with various characters. And we're not going to say that they're gay, or we're not going to say that they're a lesbian, but we're going to throw these little things in there that make you kind of wonder. And that was the rule for decades. I mean, they did that a lot.
Well, especially like I was saying with the original Cat People.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of coding in that film, a lot of looks, a lot of, you know, walkarounds. Billy Wilder was one of those directors that would openly talk about, like with The Apartment, about adultery and sex, but would never explicitly say, we're going to sex each other. It would always be like some type of walkaround or workaround with it.
Yeah, you know, eventually you got into that time where they would have, they called them the DF movies, delayed fuck movies, you know, where they were just like, you know, you couldn't do anything before you were married, but you did everything before you were married.
Also, have you guys seen The Uninvited? It's kind of like a horror, I think it's from 44.
Yeah, 44.
That one, it's like a brother and sister move into this house, and it's haunted, and the thing is, the girl thinks it's haunted by her mother, but it turns out it isn't, and there's this implied, and this is only in retrospect, I don't think a 1944 audience gathered this subtext out of it that we can looking back on it now, but there's this implied supernatural lesbian relationship between the quote mother ghost and the daughter.
Jesus.
And it's really, and the funny thing is, this is a comedy. I mean, it's a hysterical movie.
It really is. It's hilarious. But that implication was really heavy. And you go back and you look at it now and you're like, oh, wow, this is like ghost sex and everything else going on here.
But I mean, we might be jumping ahead in the timeline, but we've talked between, you know, on this podcast before, you know, talking about implications that when you look back on them, A Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2. I remember seeing that when I was 15, and I didn't even see it. I mean, and Korea made a joke. He's all, it's not even subtext, it's text. And yeah, I didn't even see that at all. I'm just thinking, oh, cool, this is a Nightmare on Elm Street movie. But then when I watched it again, probably 20 years later, I'm like, oh, this is the gayest movie of the 80s. And it really is. And I know that the guy who played the final, that's all you need to know. Instead of a final girl, there's a final guy.
Yeah.
You know, there's a final boy. But the guy who played him, he was closeted at the time, but he did wind up being gay.
Yeah, he is, and he's got a documentary out now that he's been taking around to festivals and stuff called Scream Queen, and just about his experiences on making the film and some of the stuff that happened after, because his career basically ended after that movie because of some of the things that the writer and the directors did on that film. So
the writer was also a homosexual, right? I believe he was, and he was putting this stuff in thinking it was subtext, but then later on he said, no, I absolutely put that stuff. And some of it, looking back, like the shower scene with the S&M coach, how did little 15-year-old me miss
bar.
That?
I mean,
Or what about towards the end when he's being chased by Freddy and he's like freaking out and like, the cute redhead is like, oh, spend the night with me. He's like, no. And he just runs to his best friend. He's like, I'm going to stay here with you. You know, little things like that. Which,
oh, yeah. And the only thing that really kind of pisses me off about that whole narrative is that through all this whole, like, gay storyline that's been going on through this whole thing, like, kissing a girl ended the horror, you know? I mean,
oh,
like,
yeah.
And that's where you run into a problem. You know, I mean, I love the movie and I love watching the movie, but I get to that part and I'm like, fuck you. You know? I kissed a few girls once upon a time. I am still as gay as hell. So, you know?
Waylon kissed a girl and didn't like it.
I did not.
Oh. See, so yeah, I guess we're kind of jumping around the timeline on this one.
Yeah, I skipped
forward. Go ahead.
Probably 40 years, so now it's anyone's guess.
Well, I was going to bring up, because we really got into The Haunting of Hill House, so we revisited the original Haunting movie.
Oh, wow.
And they were not subtle. It was, again, one of those, they were not subtle about one of the characters being a lesbian and trying to get with one of the other female characters, but they never outright said it.
You know, one of the greatest things about that is that it was one of the first times that one of the coded queer characters lived. Like, up until then, they would code these characters as gay or lesbian or bisexual or whatever, but they would have to die by the end of the film. They would have to die. And she was one of the first, Theo was one of the first characters to survive all the way to the end of the movie. So, yeah, that's one of my favorites. I love The Haunting.
Now, do you think that it's, this is me just thinking of this, because we talked about the vampire movies of the 70s, which they all seem to be adaptations of Carmilla. Do you think it's easier for audiences to accept a lesbian relationship
absolutely.
Than a male? Yeah, I didn't even get the question out.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean,
I think it is, too.
Well, there's the titillation factor. I mean, let's not forget who the target audience for most of these films was.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's the titillation factor, but also, how do I say this? Men's parts are all on the outside, and that's scarier. There are a lot of people who don't really know what it is that lesbians do, so they kind of go with it. But men, they have a pretty good idea, and there's this problem in that, you know, people think that being gay or whatever is all about what you do in the bedroom, and it's really a lot more than that, but that's how it gets coded. And so, you know, you run into these problems where everybody is terrified that they're going to see a penis. And when you run into that, you know, I mean, you can't hide those things. So, yeah, there's it's the titillation factor. It's a lot of things. But, yeah, lesbians are much more acceptable in the horror genre than gay men by a long shot.
It's much easier to hide a woman's private parts than it is a man's when
absolutely.
One is naked.
Yeah, I was gonna add, I feel like there's a lot of queer coding, especially in vampire movies throughout the years.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, because, like, 70s had the Hammer horror stuff with the vampire lovers, but, you know, And, you know, I'm just thinking to, like, the 80s, you know, especially funny because there was The Hunger, Tony Scott, with Susan Sarandon getting into a relationship with a vampire woman.
Oh, man, that was phenomenal. I just watched that recently. Like, the whole buildup, and I love how, like, Susan Sarandon's character, like, when the first seduction happens in The Hunger, like, she has, like, a drink, but, like, she just goes for it. Like, it's not... A lot of times you see those scenes where, like, the vampire tries to court someone of the same sex. It's usually, like, they get them drunk or something. But no, Susan Sarandon just, like, was in it.
I forget her name, but yeah, the vampire woman also being bisexual, because she's in a relationship with David Bowie.
Right.
Yeah, and bisexuality is another one of those things. It's the titillation factor. Things could really go either way, and that really plays out a lot in vampire movies, because you have that longevity. Like, you've lived for hundreds of years, so why would you do the same thing over and over and over again for hundreds of years? You'd probably branch out at some point. If for nothing else, you got bored. So it's... You know, they use that. The other thing that gets used a lot more for gay men is the whole werewolf narrative. And it's, yeah. You know, that thing that only comes out at night and you have to keep it hidden and all of those things. So a lot of that coding happens also with gay men with werewolves. So,
well, and there's even a reading of Lost Boys where between David and Michael, David is like, join us, Michael, come to our side. What will it take? You know, and you're like, is he trying to convince him to be something he's not, or is he trying to get him to admit he is something? It's you could read anything into anything if you try hard enough, but there are certain movies where I think it might be there, as you know, under the surface. So, you know, you peel the layers of the onion aside, you know, and again, that's a vampire movie doing it.
Well, yeah, and Schumacher had a lot to do with that too. I mean, he's pretty fabulous. Yeah. So, you know, he kind of went for it in that one too. I mean, those guys were glamorous and they were all into one another.
Schumacher's also not shy about saying Corey Haim's character was gay, which, you know, there's a lot of hints in that movie with that. Yeah. I mean, you go in the bedroom and there's a shirtless poster of Rob Lowe hanging up in his closet.
Yeah, subtle nods.
Subtle. Nothing's more subtle than shirtless Rob Lowe.
Oh, and I was saying while we're on the topic of vampires still, especially in the 80s, there's supposedly, you know, a lot of subtext in Fright Night.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, and you know, here's one of the things. And, you know, when you're gay or lesbian, bi, trans, whatever, you know, you're looking for representation in the movies that you love, and you're not finding it. So we spend a lot of time reading ourselves into these things in one way or another. But, yeah, you start looking at the whole Jerry Dandridge character in Fright Night. And his relationship with his buddy that takes care of him during the daytime and stuff like that. And it's not hard to see that as a gay couple. It's really not hard. I mean, if you're starved for representation, you really will read those things in. But then some directors come along and they give you something that you really don't have to work at. You know, I mean, it's there.
Well, Waylon, you and I were talking about it the other day when we were discussing doing this podcast about movies like Carrie, where there might not have been any intentional subtext or really that much subtext to it at all, but it's still widely accepted and loved by the community.
Absolutely. Carrie is probably my favorite example. And, you know, for Queer Horror Month, for Pride Month, I do a lot of interviews, and you would be surprised how often Carrie comes up in those interviews, because we all see it. I mean, the bullying, the being the other on the outside, the crazy religious fundamentalist mother who's like literally throwing you in a closet and telling you to pray and be better and stuff. It's not hard to read that one. And yeah, a lot of people have connected with Carrie since it came out. What? 40 years ago now. God, long time ago.
Not to mention the campy acting of the mother.
Oh, God. I mean, Piper Laurie is a goddess.
We're all going to laugh at you.
You need to pray the sin. No devil's pillows.
The only redeeming factor of the Carrie remake, in my opinion, is Julianne Moore in that. And she's no Piper Laurie, but she's the only one who realized that they were making... Basically, they were trying to remake one of the greatest horror movies ever. So she just had fun with it and went.
Well, and she played it in a very different way. And I love that she took that fanaticism to that sort of quiet, even scarier place. You know, when she's sitting there having the conversation with Sue's mother, and she's digging that pin into her leg to try to control her rage. I mean, that was terrifying. That scene terrified me.
Now, we're talking a lot about subtext over the years. Do you think that's changed over the last few? Because we're mainly talking about stuff through the 80s. Do you think over the last few decades that we're kind of seeing more films and filmmakers come out with films that aren't so subtle and are more overt and are making stuff better in it?
I think we're seeing more actually out gay characters. The problem is we're also running into a lot of tokenism with them. So it's like we introduce them, hey, they're gay, 5 minutes later they're dead, you know? So it's like, so we run into a lot of that. But then I know Jacob has seen it. There's Knifeheart that just came out just recently, and that is one of the most gorgeous modern giallo films that I have seen. And
loved
I don't
it.
Know how long. I mean, the lighting, the melodramatic storyline, and it all takes place in gritty, dirty 1970s gay porn. I mean, that's the setting for it. This woman runs a porn studio where she makes gay male porn, and someone starts killing off her characters. And if you guys, have you guys seen Cruising?
Yes. In fact, the thing was, I saw Knifeheart in a double feature with Cruising at Tarantino Theater, the New Beverly, earlier this month. And they played well off each other, to say the least.
Yeah, that opening kill in Knifeheart is a direct homage. I mean, they...
Oh, definitely.
They went crazy with it, but basically, you know, the guy's tied down onto the bed, he's face down, and the guy is all, like, coming up behind him and everything. But then in Knifeheart, rather than just a knife, you know, we're doing giallo, we're doing melodramatic. Guy pulls a dildo out of his pants, and a giant knife comes out of the dildo, and he uses the dildo knife to kill the dude, and I mean, they just went for it.
The other interesting thing about Knife Heart is that even though it takes place prominently in the male gay porn industry, there is a subplot with the lesbian director in a dysfunctional relationship with her editor, which, you know, is kind of on a couple levels, because, you know, it's like the relationship between the director and the editor, and you know, this this loving relationship that's in trouble because they were on good terms before, but like they're hitting the rocks on top of, you know, the murders happening. So it's just kind of interesting to see that, you know, in retrospect, seeing that parallel.
Oh yeah, and you know, dealing with a lot of things that are still issues in the queer community, with some of the drug use and some of the things that are so prominent that we still work on, you know, alcoholism and drug abuse and all of these things. So that's one of those things that they just really went for. I mean, they didn't try to hide anything. This movie is dirty. It's gritty. And I mean, the nothing is beautified about it. They really just go for it, showing really, you know, what it was like to be in that environment. And I was really proud of that movie. I know some people had some problems with it, but geez, that was really well made.
Let's get back on talking about Cruising, because, yeah, I'm still trying to think about it, you know, like where I stand on it. It is an interesting William Friedkin made thriller, and it is interesting kind of to see that type of movie from, you know, that time period, the early 80s. And yeah, I don't know, just there's still a lot to unpack about that, especially, you know, the ambiguity toward the end.
Yeah, and he played that ambiguity up throughout the film, because he had a different person play the killer in every scene that the killer was in. So they were different heights, they were different builds, you were never entirely sure who the killer was, you know, throughout that film. So he really played with the audience. The big problem with Cruising was when it was released. There was just so much going on, especially in the gay male community, and a lot of the community received this as sort of an indictment of the community, saying this is what all gay men are like, and they're all a bunch of, you know, leather-wearing freaks out there killing one another. And that's the way it was taken by some of the community at the time. I think it's aged pretty well. Of course, I didn't see this when it first came out. I was like 3 years old in 1980 when this came out. So I saw it as an adult, and I was like, wow, I'm really into this, you know. But I'm from a completely different generation from the people who were watching it at the time and who were really upset about it at the time. It was being protested. It was there were people who were the subjects of gay bashing after the film, and Cruising was mentioned during the gay bashing. So yeah, there was a lot that went on with that film when it was first released.
Yeah, and like at the beginning of the movie itself, there's actually a placard saying, you know, like, this is not an indictment of the homosexual community and stuff like that. So they tried to go out of their way to not, you know, try and paint it as much.
Yeah, that placard wasn't actually added until people started protesting.
Of course.
So it wasn't there in the beginning. So yeah, they went back and added it, you know, a week or two into the run or something like that. You know, they pulled a bunch of prints and then they put it in there. So yeah, that was one of those too little too late kind of responses, you know, for some people. But yeah, it's an excellent film to watch now. It's really cool kind of psychological thriller slasher kind of film, and a lot of fun, you know, just trying to figure out who the damn killer is through the entire thing.
Yeah, and the kill scenes are very well set up, you know, and it was a perfect, you know, parallel, you know, between that and Knife and Heart, because the kill scenes are pretty inventive and intense.
You
oh,
know,
yeah. Like the opening one, like we talked about, and there's one in in like the park, Central Park. So yeah, no, Friedkin really knew how to set up, you know, just the tension on those. And also, one of my favorite scenes is like when they're being interrogated. Like Al Pacino is undercover, being interrogated by the cops along with this other guy who they think that may be the killer, and this big, like almost naked black dude with like a drill sergeant hat comes in and starts beating them up. And even the guy asks, like, what? Who is that guy?
Yeah.
And I looked into that. Apparently, it may have been a more subtle reference to, apparently the NYPD allegedly would do stuff like that because if they made, hit suspects or, like, did crazy stuff to suspects, but they did it in such a crazy way, like, nobody would believe them.
Right, right. They went completely over the top, so you go tell your crazy story, and who's gonna believe that? Like,
yeah.
Some half-naked dude came in and beat the shit out of me while I was in the interrogation room. Nobody's gonna believe that. Are there any other movies that you guys were thinking about?
I didn't really think about this till recently, but Death Becomes Her, which seems to be a pretty popular movie in the LGBTQ community, which I didn't quite understand until I, you know, gave it another watch, because, you know, it's about the whole relationship between Meryl Streep's character and Goldie Hawn's character, because, you know, they hate each other so much throughout the movie, but in the end, they get together.
Well, yeah, and there's also the camp factor in that. I mean, oh, you know, so. I mean, plus that whole, you know, youth and beauty is a premium. True. Yeah, that played up a lot in that movie too. God, I love that movie. That you know, just when they really go to town on each other and start, like, she blows a hole through the middle of her with the shotgun and everything. I mean, yeah. those were great scenes.
Oh yeah, no, the special effects still hold up really well.
Let's talk for a second about Nightbreed.
Oh yeah.
Because Nightbreed, it's almost metaphor, because Clive Barker is a gay man, and the monsters, how they keep them hidden, you know, in the closet, I guess you'd say, in a closet. And then there are other people, you know, everyone's demonizing them and stuff. But in the, I mean, they actually come out and save the day, you know, ultimately in the movie. I mean, and obviously I'm not going to say, do you think this is a conscious effort on Clive Barker's part? Because I'm sure it was. But do you think that the public actually got that reading from it?
I don't think that the straight public got that reading from it, but all of us were there for it.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
And I think that happens a lot with queer directors and writers and stuff. They put things in there so that even if the film doesn't get to be overt, their audience still knows that they're talking to them. But yeah,
it's the
you know,
Twilight Zone thing.
Yeah, you know, I wrote a little bit about Nightbreed earlier this month, and because it was included in Shudder's Queer Essentials for Pride Month. And, you know, every queer person knows about Midian. I mean, we have had clubs that were at the back of dark alleys that you had to go down and give the secret knock to get into. You know, we've had our closet. We've had all of these things. It's so overt that I'm surprised that more straight audience members didn't get it while they were watching it. I mean, it's just perfect. I mean, it's a perfect representation for some of the things that a lot of us went through and are still going through.
And I think, and also it's interesting how the villains of the movie Nightbreed are all authority figures. David Cronenberg as the evil psychologist who wants to destroy all the monsters because he has an obsession with purity.
But he's also leading a double life as a serial killer, too.
Yeah.
Which is another layer to
because he's jealous of the monsters. He wants to simultaneously destroy but also become like the monsters, which is why he has the mask. And then you've got the fanatical sheriff who wants to kill all the monsters, and like he's obsessed with normalcy, and then of course you've got a priest who's kind of along for the ride, like an alcoholic messed up priest who's kind of more dragged along, but still it's like you got like you got all those figures together. It's like that. So these figures of authority and normalcy are the enemies of Midian.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, once you really start putting it together, you have, you know, because Stonewall started because of what the police were doing. You know, you had psychologists who were telling everybody up until 40, 50 years ago that we were mentally ill. You've had the priests who still preach against us on a regular basis. You know, I mean, it's all there. The three, you know, maybe the big three that, you know, have really assaulted parts of the queer community over the years. So, yeah, I mean, it's, again, you know, when I watch it as a gay man, all of that stuff is there. I mean, it's just not hidden at all. But I think for some straight audience members who really don't, who are just there to watch a movie, they don't pick that up. It's about monsters. It's about, you know, these crazy people trying to kill monsters who maybe aren't monsters, but, you know, they look like them. So, yeah.
And again, I think when we look back on it, you know, 25 years later, it's probably easier. And maybe it's because we're more used to seeing it now than in 1990, but it's pretty easy to see the analogy looking back on it. You know, it's easy to see what Barker was doing.
Yeah, and like there's that scene where I forget her name, but the girlfriend is talking to one of the monsters, and you know she's explaining that like the humans would kill all the Midianites because they were I think it was like they said they were because like they were free or like they had abilities that they didn't and what they didn't understand or what they didn't have and wanted to be like they destroyed.
And we've seen that. I mean, that's just human. That's very much been a part of human nature. I mean, what we don't understand, we decide is the enemy. So,
yeah, like how many times have we seen or heard of like televangelists or politicians who were staunchly against like gay marriage or condemned homosexuality eventually get caught with another dude?
Oh, yeah. Generally in a public bathroom, like, I mean, you know, like
at the
at
airport.
Least try to hide yourself, you know, if you're...
Now, do you think a lot of modern television, like, I would say, like, even, like, a lot of Ryan Murphy's stuff with American Horror Story and The Town That Dreaded Sundown reboot, remake, meta, that has a lot of things to it. But anyways, do you think... a lot of like the popularity of his projects and others are helping to not only have the language and the kind of humor and the horror behind a lot of queer cinema become not more mainstream, but become more in the know, become more in the public eye.
Oh, absolutely.
And is helping it get accepted.
Absolutely. You know, Ryan Murphy is a really good example. And I know you're not particularly a fan, but John, but Sabrina, the new Sabrina, is a huge example. I mean, you have characters on there who are pansexual. You have a non-binary character who has now decided to transition to male. And they actually cast a non-binary actor to play the non-binary character, which, you know, somebody finally got smart about that.
Which I do want to say those aren't the issues I have with Sabrina. The issues
I
have
I
with Sabrina
yeah,
have
no,
to do with
yeah.
them dealing with Satanism and yeah. how they're handling that.
Yeah, no, but yeah, shows like this are really bringing the vocabulary and kind of creating that sort of, I don't know, it's normalizing us to a bit. To an extent, a bit more. You know, a couple of years ago when I was writing some of these articles, I was researching target demographics for horror films. And then I just got really curious and I started to look at the demographics of groups that were most likely to commit violence against the queer community. And there's a total overlap. So the more that we bring this in, the more that we show this sort of normalized representation, I think we're in a better place to begin maybe changing people's minds. You know, I mean, we're right there. We're in the middle of that demographic of these people who are going out and beating us and killing us and all of these things. So if we put more of us in normalized roles in front of them, it's just like seeing... you know, bad example, but you know, you see so much violence in horror movies that you get inured to it a little bit, and you, it's the same ameliorating effect. You see more queer people and more queer people who are portrayed just like a part of the group, and you start to change the way that people look at that.
That's a great place to start winding down, but I have one more question for you.
Sure.
How did the Babadook become a queer icon?
yes. Okay. I want to know about this, too.
Is it just because Netflix miscategorized it as an LGBTQ
movie at one point? What happened is that somehow somebody at Netflix accidentally put the Babadook in with the LGBT movies, and it came up and people saw it on their screens and they started screenshotting it and passing it around. And at first it was like, so this is a thing now, so like the Babadook is going to be, you know, our next icon. And so it started out as a joke, and then at the next Pride, all of a sudden there were people dressed up as the Babadook walking around through the Pride parades. And, you know, something like that happens that first year. Yeah, you expect it. But then, like, the following year, there are more people dressed as the Babadook walking around at the Pride parades, and it became this total thing. And then there was this group. They call themselves the Enemies of Dorothy, and they did this this short film where the Babadook was getting engaged to Pennywise the Clown, and yeah, that became a whole thing too. So, I mean, you see the Babadook walking around hand in hand with Pennywise at Pride, and so yeah, it grew out of a mistake, and we just kind of took it and ran with it, basically, is the way that happened. We take what we can get where we can get it, and this was one of those things that just kind of jumped out and took on a life of its own. It's really been kind of interesting to see the way that people have reacted to it, because, you know, the Babadook was kind of a symbol of mental illness and all of these things, and that is certainly something that we have dealt with as far as a stigma against us. So they kind of made it work. I mean, they just kind of jumped on it. They were like, oh yeah, the Babadook's totally gay. And, you know, they just, it grew and it grew, and here we are today, and the Babadook is at Pride every year.
Well, I just want to say before we wrap up, I just want to thank Waylon not only for coming on to our podcast, but as you were saying earlier, representation and is very important, especially in our community. We're horror fans are very passionate and are very vocal, and I think it's you're doing really not only good work, Waylon. If you ever go to iHorror.com during the month of June, Waylon pumps out an article a day, and you start this process months ahead of time, gathering interviews with writers and creators and performers, and it's astounding to see the amount of effort and the amount of good work that Waylon puts out there to make these things happen. And
if he didn't write it, it was pitched to him and he greenlit it and probably set it up. So it's not just the stuff with his byline. It's just about everything that hits the site in June.
I start reaching out to people somewhere in December or January to start setting up interviews for this. So yeah, I work on Pride Month for 6 months, you know, just getting it ready to go, but it's totally worth it to me. And thank you guys for like saying, hey, come on and talk to us about what you've been doing and talk to us about queer horror. This has been very, very cool.
Happy to have you.
Yeah, we've been wanting to get you on for a while. I mean, you're one of our original fans, and you're one of the like biggest voices on iHorror. So it should have happened sooner. Is all I can say.
But also seemed like the perfect time to do it, though. So you know, and like you say, low hanging fruit. But this discussion, I mean, you kind of took all of us to school, you know. we were just asking the questions, and then there's which is how it should be. That's kind of the way it was with Kelly as well. So you know, yeah, I mean, you could say low hanging fruit getting Waylon on for, you know, talking queer horror, but there's a reason we do that, you know.
Well, and anytime you guys want me back, you just let me know, because this has been a blast.
We need to get you on to talk about haunted house movies, because I
absolutely
know that's
I'm
another,
down for that.
Which, another thing, another question before we let you go. When is Among the Shadows coming back? Waylon has a podcast, Among the Shadows, which is about paranormal investigating, and it's been on a bit of a hiatus. So let's get the scoop.
We have been on a bit of a hiatus. I had a lot of job issues that went on this year, and things have been a little crazy getting through Pride Month, but I'm hoping to start it back up next month, and it's called Among the Shadows. And like I said in our introductory podcast, you know, over a year ago, we're going to talk about ghosts and aliens and Mothman and Bigfoot and whatever, you know. I mean, we're going to do
it
all.
You had me at Bigfoot.
so yeah, and I really enjoy that's one of my go-to topics, so I'm hoping to start that up again next month, and we'll be back next month.
And where can our listeners find you on the social medias if they're wanting to get more of Waylon?
Well, on Twitter, I am there as at WaylonVox1. That's WaylonVox1. I'm a really bad Instagrammer. You can follow me there if you want to, but you're not going to see much. So, and that's Waylon.Jordan. So yeah, you can find me there.
Cool. All right. Well, let's start wrapping this up. Our music is Restless Spirit. Hey, and guess what? They just released a new version of the song that is our theme song. It's called Young Graves on Spotify. It sounds to me like they re-recorded it. It sounds like it might be a little slower and heavier, and there's like another guitar solo in it. Anyway, Restless Spirit does our music, and so go and check them out on Spotify, and you know, you can hear the whole version of that song, not just the 20 seconds I whittled it down to. Our artwork is Chris Fisher, so go give him some love as well. We know where to find Waylon. Jacob, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at @JacobDavison_. That is at @JacobDavison_.
And Korea?
And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Korean Barbecue. That's CorreanBBQ. And don't forget to check us out also on iHorror.com and on the Stardust app at iHorror.
And you can find me on Twitter at Cinema Fierite. That's like verite but with fear, so it's F-E-A-R-I-T-E. And you can find all three of us and Waylon, we'll make sure a message gets to him, at the Eye on Horror Facebook page, or you can get all four of us at the Eye Horror Facebook page, the Eye Horror fan page if you're lucky. I think we all look at it, but I don't know if we spend too much time there, or just at iHorror.com. None of us are hard to reach if you have anything to say to us. So we're going to get out of here, and we will see you in a couple weeks. So for me, James J. Edwards.
I'm Jacob Davison.
I'm Jonathan Correa.
And hey, I'm Waylon Jordan.
Keep your eye on horror.